This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with jazz singer Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, whose repertoire ranges from jazz standards to forgotten old songs, show tunes, and originals. Salvant was described in the New York Times as the finest jazz singer to emerge in the last decade. In 2013, critic Stephen Holden wrote in the Times, "If anyone can extend the lineage of the Big Three, Billie Holiday, Sarah Vaughan, and Ella Fitzgerald, it's this 23-year-old virtuoso." Salvant, who's now 26, was exposed to a lot of different music growing up in Miami, with a father from Haiti and a French mother who was born in Tunisia and lived in several African and Latin American countries. Cecile McLaurin-Salvant has a new album called For One to Love. Let's start with a track. It's an unusual song choice, Stepsister's Lament from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical Cinderella.
Why should a fella want a girl like her, a frail and fluffy beauty? Why can't a fella ever once prefer a solid girl like me? She's a frothy little bubble with a flimsy kind of air and with very little trouble. I could pull out all her hair. Oh, oh, why would a fella want a girl like her? A girl who's so unusual. Why can't a fella ever once prefer a usual girl like me? Her cheeks are a pretty shade of pink, but not any pinker than roses. Her skin may be delicate and soft, but not any softer than a doe's. Her neck is no longer than a swan's. She's only as dainty as a daisy. She's only as graceful as a bird. So why is the fella going crazy? Oh, why would a fella want a girl like her?
Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, welcome to Fresh Air. I really like that you choose songs in the jazz-standard repertoire and songs way outside of the repertoire, like Stepsister's Lament. When I heard you sing that live, you said that the first version of that you heard was actually sung by Brandy. Tell us how old you were then and what that song meant to you.
It was actually not sung by Brandy. It was sung by these two actresses who were in the movie with Brandy, who played her stepsisters.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so Brandy was Cinderella, and then she had these two awful stepsisters who sang her song.
I should have figured that.
I'll say I was around 10. And I related with it because, you know, it's the point of view of the girl who is often invisible and looked over, and I definitely felt that way and feel that way still a lot in my life. I just didn't feel like I could relate to the beautiful princess or the girl who gets the guy, or, you know, I could relate with that yearning and that jealousy and frustration more.
Now, I want to compare Stepsister's Lament from Cinderella, your version of that, with an original song that you wrote that's on your new album. And this is a song called Look at Me. And the feeling of the song is kind of similar. The lyric includes the line, look at me, why don't you look at me the way you look at all the other girls you see. Can you talk a little bit about writing this song before we hear it?
I wrote that. I have a good friend that started sending me poems via email, and I would respond, and we just started writing like that. It had been such a long time since I'd just written poems with, you know, no music, and I was experiencing that friend zone, which is you know, that's, I guess, the name for being in love with a friend who doesn't love you back. And I was experiencing that, and I felt the need, the urge to write it out, write it down. And couple months later, I started looking at the lyrics and thinking, oh, maybe this could be a song.
Well, this is a beautiful ballad. The style of the song is the opposite of Stepsister's Lament. So let's hear Cecile McLaurin-Salvant's song, Look at Me, from her new album, For One to Love.
Look at me. Why don't you look at me the way you look at all the other girls you see? I'm your friend, I guess I'll always be. But I'm in love with you endlessly. All the time, all of the time I've lost trying to make you come to me.
That's Cecile McLaurin-Salvant from her new album, For One to Love. It's a song she wrote called Look at Me. So now that you're on stage and becoming famous within the jazz world, more people are looking at you, I mean literally. Do you like being the focus of attention when you're on stage?
It's weird. I'll say in a way I love it. I mean, I do love being on stage, and I've always loved playing a character and being watched doing that. I remember in school, in elementary school, I used to recite poems. We'd have to recite poems, and I would always just, like, roll on the floor, like, just make it such a huge melodramatic portrayal of whatever it was, you know. But in another sense, I don't like being the focus of attention. It makes me very uncomfortable, and it's part of the reason I never look at videos of myself, or I very rarely listen to my music, or even read things that I might have said. It's just there's something repulsive about it to me. Maybe that's a strong word.
But that's a very strong word.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't like to be in my own. I'm already myself, so I don't like to be in my own, watch myself.
Well, we need to talk about your incredible voice. When I listen to you, I hear elements of Sarah Vaughan, Abby Lincoln, Betty Carter, Billie Holiday. When you started listening to those singers, did you, when you were young, try to copy them to really learn how they did what they did, the way some writers copy paragraphs of favorite writers to better understand the structure and flow of the words in their favorite writers' sentences?
I would say for certain singers, I definitely went through that. I definitely went through that with Sarah Vaughan as I think I started really falling in love with her voice when I was about 14. My mother loves Sarah Vaughan, and she always played her music from as long as I can remember. But when I was about 14, I started really checking her out for myself, by myself, and thinking, gosh, that voice is incredible. I was really mostly interested in classical singing, but she had something in there that drew me in. She was an absolute virtuoso, and she could have so many colors and textures with her voice. So it became, when I moved to France and started singing jazz and studying it, really, she was maybe the first person that I would copy, and it became less about sounding unique. I didn't even care about that. I just wanted to sound as much like her as I possibly could. And so I'd spend a lot of time listening to her and seeing how I could make my voice sound like that. And then eventually it moved on to other singers. Billie Holiday was a big one, where I would pay attention to the way she would pronounce words, the way she, even just her accent. all of that became really interesting to me, and vibrato and all of that. And eventually, the more I listened and became obsessed with singers, I feel like the more I realized that I had my own little thing that I could do, and so this is why I just became obsessed with looking for new singers, unknown singers, people that maybe have been forgotten, and really checking them out and analyzing what they do, and obsessive listening. I think that's the core of my work on music has been just listening to things, listening to singers.
So after listening so obsessively to so many singers, did you ever go through an identity crisis as a singer yourself and wonder, but who am I? I can sound like these people, I love those people, but what is uniquely me?
Oh, still today. Every day. It's a total identity crisis for me of like, is there even a point in doing this? Is this even relevant? You know, what am I doing? Who do I sound like? I remember as a child, I still today do not have my own handwriting. I just would copy everyone else's handwriting. And now I have sort of a version of my sister's handwriting. And I feel like sometimes I feel that way for my voice. Like sometimes I'm doing a patchwork, like a bad quilt of all the people that I love. But then I doubt myself a lot, and I'm very, very just overly critical. So I know that it's probably not that.
You have such an amazing instrument. I mean, you have such an amazing voice, and you use it with such emotional and tonal and notey range. So I also think that, like, writing your own songs is probably helping you find, like, your own musical identity.
Sure. Writing my own songs and also the time and care I take in choosing the repertoire. It takes me a lot of time, and it's almost frustrating for the guys sometimes because they're waiting for a new song, and it's just so important for me to get the perfect, exact, right song.
One of the things I really like about your repertoire is that you go back to early jazz and you find music from the early 19th century and early 20th century, I mean, and from the 1920s and 30s. And you've also gone back and looked for songs by women composers. Like you do a song by Blanche Calloway, Cab Calloway's sister, on your new album. You do some Clarence Williams songs from, I guess, the 1930s. And in addition to finding a lot of old songs, I think you're trying to turn some recent songs, or at least one recent song on its head, and kind of reinterpret it. And I'm thinking of Wives and Lovers, which is just one of the all-time, like, sexist songs. It was a 1963 hit by Jack Jones, music by Burt Bacharach, and a lyric by Hal David. And they are such a fabulous songwriting team, and I don't know how this particular song happened. but why in the world would you sing a song that... Why don't you recite the lyric?
Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon he will open the door. Don't think because there's a ring on your finger, you needn't try anymore. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. I'm warning you.
Why?
I just, sometimes I just find things so funny because they're so absurd to me, and I find the humor in it, and I think it's going to be funny, and I don't even think of it, like, as a politically charged thing. But that particular song I found, actually, because I was looking up sexist songs. I have a really good friend who, I'm a feminist. She knows I'm a feminist. She's like, why aren't you, you know, singing more feminist songs? And I thought, gee, that's true. So I started trying to do some research, trying to find some songs in the American American popular song history, even folk songs or whatever it may be that had feminist themes to them. And it was very hard. It was very difficult to find. And so I decided, let me just check out if there are any sexist songs. And of course, that was a lot easier.
Yeah, I'll say.
And that song happens to be so catchy, and I love that song, and I think it's hilarious. And it actually, I remember playing it for a few friends, and we had this big debate on whether feminism was still appropriate, whether it was a real thing, whether, you know, and we started talking about gender and all these things that are really important to me. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. I'm glad that we could talk about these things just from listening to this particular song.
Okay, so we should hear a little bit of you singing it. So this is Wives and Lovers from Cecile McLaren Salvant's new album, For One to Love. So as you listen, go comb your hair and fix your makeup. Here we go.
Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon he will open the door. Don't think because there's a ring on your finger. You needn't try anymore. For wives should
Cecile McLaren Salvant from her new album, For One to Love. I feel like there should be like giant quotation marks around that song when you sing it. Because you're singing it straight. Like, if you just played that for me, I wouldn't know that you thought, like, that's like an incredibly sexist but very catchy song. I mean, of course it's catchy. I mean, Burt Bacharach wrote the music. Like,
yeah, of course. But I mean, I feel like today, hearing that song today, you wouldn't be like, okay, I need to go fix myself up and, you know, wax and
no.
And when I sing it live, there's a line about curlers, about not leaving your husband with your hair still in curlers, and I don't have hair really. My hair's really short. So I think that kind of lets people know that I don't really.
So I'm just wondering, when you look for sexist songs, what are some of the ones that came up that you decided not to do?
Not to do yet is a song. He hit me and it felt like a kiss.
Right. That Phil Spector produced that one.
Yeah.
And that's one, more of a girl group, like a rock and roll girl group song.
Yeah. That one definitely stays with me, and I'm thinking that maybe it'll come up. There's other songs that are, I don't know if I would say that they're completely sexist, but kind of, you know, there's a "When I'm Housekeeping for You" or "I'm Cooking Breakfast for the One I Love." That's not super sexist.
Oh, that's Fanny Brice.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of like that song.
I kind of like it too.
My baby likes bacon, and that's what I'm making. So I'm cooking breakfast for the One I Love.
Yeah, yeah. That's not really. It's sexist in the context that it was written, but. But a man could sing that to me, I'd be very happy to hear it.
So my guest is singer Cecile McLaren Salvant. She has a new album called For One to Love. I'd like to end with one more song. And I was thinking of the Trolley Song from your new album, which is a song that Martin and Blaine wrote for Meet Me in St. Louis for the movie, starring Judy Garland, who sings this in a great scene in the movie. Why did you choose this song?
This is one of those where I just became obsessed with the song itself, and there was no other reasoning behind it. I saw the scene in question, and it became my life. It was, I would watch it maybe 6-8 times a day, maybe more. Anytime I had a moment, I would sit down, find it on YouTube and watch it. And it just became clear that I needed to sing it. Like I needed to, there was some reason I needed to get to that, to the inside of that song. And yeah, man, that scene is so amazing. I love it. I'm gonna watch it in a few minutes, I think.
And this is the same movie that Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas was written for.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Oh my goodness.
Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much, and I look forward to hearing much more of your singing. And here's Cecile McLaurin-Salvant singing the trolley song.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heartstrings. From the moment I saw him, I fell. Chug, chug, chug went the motor. Bump, bump, bump went the brakes. Thump, thump, thump went my heartstrings. When he smiled, I could feel the car shake. He tipped his hat and took a seat. He said he hoped he hadn't stepped upon my feet. He asked my name, I held my breath. I couldn't speak because he scared me half to death. Buzz, buzz, buzz went the buzzer. Plop, plop, plop went the wheels. Stop, stop, stop went my heartstrings. When he started to go, then I started to know how it feels. When the universe reels. Buzz, buzz went the buzzer. Clop, clop, clop went the wheels. Stop, stop, stop went my heartstrings. When he started to leave, I took hold of his sleeve with my hand. And as if it were planned, he stayed on with me, and it was grand just to stand with his hand holding mine to the end of the line.
Cecile McLaurin-Salvant's latest album is called For One to Love. You can hear a longer version of her conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Eddie Redmayne won an Academy Award earlier this year for his portrayal of Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything. He undergoes an equally dramatic transformation in The Danish Girl, Tom Hooper's new film about an early transgender icon. Justin Chang has this review.
We are witnessing a creative renaissance in stories about transgender characters. As fans of the Amazon series Transparent or the independent film Tangerine can attest. But when it comes to showcasing a community that's still fighting for recognition and understanding, there's perhaps a case to be made for a prestige biopic set in a less enlightened era, and told in an old-fashioned classical style that can make even the thorniest issues seem as unthreatening as a glass of warm milk. That's about as passionate a defense as I can muster for The Danish Girl, a well-acted and excruciatingly tasteful new movie about Lili Elbe, the transgender pioneer who in 1930 became one of the first people to undergo a series of gender reassignment surgeries. Adapted from David Ebersoff's book of the same title, The Danish Girl is a story about some of the most elusive mysteries of the mind and body, and the ways in which human nature can resist the rules and traditions of polite society. But as directed by Tom Hooper, the British filmmaker known for The King's Speech and Les Misérables, The Danish Girl is nothing if not polite. For all its hand-wringing about the importance of being true to one's inner self, the film winds up feeling timid, incurious, and weirdly devoid of feeling. It's all glossy, mannered period surface. That's a problem for a story that's supposedly about the allure of outward appearances and the enormous depths they can conceal. Lili Elbe was born Einar Wegener, a popular Danish landscape artist who, in the 1920s, enjoyed a life of passionate romantic and creative partnership with his wife, the portrait painter Gerda Gottlieb. The intertwining of love and art supplies a key motif here. When her female model is late one day, Gerda asks her husband to pose for her in women's stockings and shoes, a practical solution that also doubles as a sly bit of bohemian role-play. Transfixed by the softness of the fabric against his skin, Einar soon finds himself secretly trying on his wife's negligee and mimicking the exquisite body language of the women he sees in the street. Clearly, there's more going on here than a simple game of dress-up. We're seeing an entirely new identity slowly taking shape. And the full flowering of that new identity occurs when Gerda convinces Einar to go out in public as Lily, passing her off as Einar's cousin. At one soiree, Gerda makes a show of introducing Lily to her friend Ulla, the only other person at this point who knows that it's really Einar beneath the stylish frock and the dark red wig.
Ulla, let me introduce. It's Lily. That's right. Einar's cousin from Vila. My dear, how exquisite. In, let's go in. Come on.
Einar and Lily are played by the talented British actor Eddie Redmayne, and he fully conveys Lily's delight, confusion, and panic as she savors and explores her newfound freedom. The actor's most haunting scenes are virtually wordless. At one point, Einar visits a brothel in Paris, where a session with a peep show prostitute becomes an exercise not in gratification, but in identification, as he studies the feminine gestures that will arouse the desires of other men. Still, as with Redmayne's performance in The Theory of Everything, we seem to be watching a virtuoso technical display that never feels entirely fleshed out. And as the film progresses, the actor falls into a series of repetitive poses that obscure, rather than illuminate, the character's essence. There are some fine supporting performances here, particularly from Matthias Schoenaerts as Hans, a childhood friend of Einar's who provides moral and emotional support, and from Sebastian Koch as an enlightened German doctor who shows Lily a pathway to self-fulfillment. And Redmayne is more than matched by the radiant Alicia Vikander as Gerda, fully illuminating the conflicted feelings of a woman who chose to stand by her husband even after he decided he could no longer play that particular role. Like The Theory of Everything, The Danish Girl is about a loving but untenable marriage, and it's to the movie's credit and its detriment that Gerda emerges as a frankly more interesting character than either Einar or Lily. Part of the problem is with Lucinda Coxon's screenplay, which seems reluctant to delve into some of the more intriguing aspects of Einar and Lily's contrasting personalities. Frankly, The Danish Girl cries out to be remade by a director like David Cronenberg, who could have teased out the story's intellectual and psychological nuances, and perhaps brought out a dimension of corporeal horror that Hooper sweeps all too neatly under the rug. By the end, you wouldn't guess that Redmayne's character has undergone a painful and exceedingly traumatic medical procedure. You emerge from this movie instead with visions of cream-colored scarves and gorgeous Scandinavian locations dancing in your head, and almost zero sense of the cost, spiritual, emotional, or physical, that Einar and Lily paid to become the woman they always wanted to be.
Justin Chang is chief film critic at Variety. He reviewed director Tom Hooper's new film, The Danish Girl, starring Eddie Redmayne. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with music writer Peter Guralnick, author of the new book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Ike Turner, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, Howlin' Wolf, and B.B. King are some of the great musicians discovered by Sam Phillips. Phillips recorded many of the performers he worked with on Sun Records, the label he founded in Memphis in 1952 and sold in 1969. Phillips died in 2003 at the age of 80. Peter Guralnick is the author of the definitive two-volume biography of Elvis, a biography of Sam Cooke, and books about soul, blues, and country music. He's described Sam Phillips as having left a remarkable legacy, both of black blues and the white adaptation of it, which became rock and roll. Along with the new biography of Phillips, Guralnick has compiled a double CD, also called Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. It collects many of Guralnik's favorite tracks that Phillips produced. Let's start with a track from that new compilation. This is an impromptu recording made after Elvis walked in on a Carl Perkins recording session where a then-unknown Jerry Lee Lewis was at the piano.
I shall not be moved. Just like a tree
just like
that's
a tree.
Growing in the meadow.
Down by the water.
I shall not be moved. I'm on my way to glory land. I shall not be moved. On my way to glory land. I will not be moved.
Look around the tree.
I shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's planted by the water. I shall not be moved.
Peter Guralnik, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've written about Sam Phillips before in writing about other musicians, most especially in your two-volume book about Elvis Presley. Why did you want to devote a separate book to Sam Phillips?
Well, because I think he's as original and as strikingly individuated and as determinedly motivated and an artist, really, as anybody I've ever written about. And from the time that I first started writing, he was somebody who absolutely fascinated me, which is the reason I spent 10 years trying to get an interview with him.
So you describe Sam Phillips as an artist. What makes him an artist?
Well, you know, let's call him a visionary then. I mean, he is an artist in terms of audio. That was the one thing that he took the greatest pride in, that he could get, he could hear sound, he could get sound. He prided himself not just on his microphone placement, but on his use of the equipment, on replicating sound in a way that was realer than real. He wasn't interested in having a sterile, you know, washed out, perfect version of sound which just had no life. He created a live sound. But his vision from the very beginning was that music, and specifically African-American music, could conquer all of the prejudice, all of the race prejudice, the, you know, the class prejudice, the divisions, the categories into which music, like everything else in American life, was divided. And from long before he started the studio in 1950, he believed that the music in which he so strongly espoused, which was primarily African American music, that this music would, once a mainstream audience, and by that you can mean you can read largely white, once a mainstream audience encountered this music, they would be won over completely.
Helen Wolfe, the great blues musician singer, Helen Wolfe, was one of Sam Phillips' first big discoveries. Talk about the importance of Helen Wolfe in blues and rock and roll history.
Well, I think what Sam said when he first heard Helen Wolfe, a friend of his, an engineer over at KWEM in West Memphis, said, "We've got this guy on the air every day around noon, selling farm implements and farm tools, and he's the kind of guy he plays the kind of music I think you'd be interested in," which I don't think was intended as a compliment by this friend of Sam's. I don't think he meant it entirely altogether positively. But Sam always said, he tuned into the program on KWEM. It was a weak signal. It came through crackling. It was a terrible connection. And he said that from the first moment he heard Howlin' Wolf's voice, he said, "This is it for me. This is where the soul of man ever dies." And I'm with Sam on that. I mean, I think Sam, you know, Howlin' Wolf was not just the epitome of Sam's vision of expressing. I mean, Sam considered him and Charlie Rich too, two totally different musicians. He considered them the most profound artists he ever recorded. The first time Sam invited Wolf into the studio, he tried to make it as low-key as possible. He didn't want to put any pressure on him. He didn't want Wolf to feel that he was making a command performance or that some little white guy was trying to twist him in some direction. When Wolf came in with the guitarist Willie Johnson and the drummer Willie Steele, and Sam said he was so overwhelmed He was just so overcome by the sound of the music that for the one of the few times in his life, he had no idea what to do. I mean, he prided himself on everything to do with recording. And he said he was out there in the studio moving the mics around, but really he wasn't doing anything. He was just completely mesmerized by the sound of Howlin' Wolf's voice.
Okay, so let's hear Howlin' Wolf. And this is Moanin' at Midnight from the early 1950s.
Hey, somebody knocking on my door.
That's Howlin' Wolf, as recorded by Sam Phillips. My guest is Peter Guralnick, who's written a new book about Sam Phillips called Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. And there's a companion CD, and the track we just heard is featured on it. Let's hear some more music. Elvis is probably, is definitely Sam Phillips' most famous discovery and the discovery that most changed music. And you have this new compilation that's a companion to the Sam Phillips book. It's a collection of recordings that he produced. And you suggested that we play back-to-back Elvis's Mystery Train and Junior Parker's recording, Love My Baby. Now, Junior Parker had recorded Mystery Train before Elvis did, but why did you want to play Love My Baby back-to-back with Elvis's version of Mystery Train?
Well, Love My Baby really provided the model for Mystery Train. Elvis recorded Mystery Train. One of the things that he was most drawn to of the recordings that Sam made was Little Junior Parker's Mystery Train. Love My Baby was the B-side, or I don't know if there were A-sides and B-sides so much, but Love My Baby, the guitar part by Floyd Murphy, is almost the exact pattern for rockabilly that came along a year or two later. I mean, in fact, Sam believed in the record so strongly that he had no doubt that this record was going to be the one to cross over. And if you listen to it now, there couldn't be anything but color that prevented it from being a major pop hit. But
by color, but you mean Junior Parker was black?
Exactly, yeah. As was his band, the Blue Flames.
Mm-hmm.
Sam played Love My Baby in particular over and over again for Scotty Moore, Elvis's guitarist. And you can hear on Elvis's Mystery Train, it's not imitation in any way. Incidentally, the guitarist in the Blue Flames was Floyd Murphy, who was Matt Guitar Murphy's younger brother. He was about 18 at the time he recorded it, and Sam considered him one of the finest guitarists he had ever encountered. But Scotty studied it. Sam's lesson to Scotty, who was a great musician and a great man. I mean, as Sam said of Scotty, he's the most honest man I ever met. If he disagrees with me, well, I don't know, there's something wrong with me. But he played this Love My Baby for Scotty because his lesson to Scotty was to simplify. I mean, Sam was a Thoreauvian in his own way, the guitar solo or the driving sound on Love My Baby was so much what Sam was looking for in music in general. I mean, in much of the music that he recorded.
Okay, so let's hear back-to-back Little Junior Parker's recording of Love My Baby and Elvis's version of Mystery Train. And both of these recordings are on the Sam Phillips compilation that's the companion to Peter Guralnick's new biography of Sam Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
yourself. Well, her friends don't know it, don't really know. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. No, not again. Train, train.
That was Elvis Presley doing Mystery Train, and before that, Little Junior Parker doing Love My Baby. And my guest is Peter Guralnick. He's the author of a new book about Sam Phillips called The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, and he's put together a double CD compilation of recordings made by Sam Phillips, many of which I confess I was unfamiliar with before because some of them are relatively obscure. So you and your recording compilation, the anthology of Sam Phillips recordings, with Elvis is trying to get to you. And I think you end it for a very specific reason. So I thought we'd end our interview with that recording too, and I'll ask you why it's the end.
Well, I hope it's not the end. Maybe it's the introduction to a future that we can't envision yet. But it's, no, I always thought that Trying to Get to You was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, of all the songs that Elvis recorded for Sam and Son. But in fact, it's not the version that we're about to hear that reaches its pinnacle. It's the next take, which was never done, that would have been the transcendent version. But it's an astonishing performance, and there's so much conviction and so much belief in it. And it's really a spiritual performance in the terms that you were speaking of earlier, Sam's belief in the spirituality of the music. One of the things that's most extraordinary about it is it's a song that stayed with Elvis all his life, and even at the very end of his life, in his last or his next-to-last concert, he's singing it with the same conviction and the same desperation. It always had a freshness and a spontaneity that, you know, some of his hits didn't always bring out of him at the end. It's one of these many, it's like so many songs. How do you define what it is about Funny How Time Slips Away that's so great? But it's a song, or You Are My Sunshine, but it's a song you can listen to again and again. And with Elvis's commitment to it, it's really an extraordinary achievement.
What do you mean by the next take that was never made would have been the best?
Because I think they were on the verge of refining the song, of simplifying the song, of creating the same kind of take that Elvis had on A Mystery Train. But Elvis's career at Sun was just then coming to an end, and he never came back into the studio to do another take.
Oh, so did Sam Phillips intend to do another take?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I mean, I think, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think this is not a final version, and yet in its raw spontaneity, it continues. It represents Elvis's music as well as anything I can think of. Sam didn't release this, but one of the reasons he couldn't have released it is he sold the contract before he might have. But no, I don't think there's any question that this was a song in the process of evolving, and Elvis puts everything into it. It seems to me that the instrumentation, not that he would change the instrumentation, but that it could have been refined, it could have been simplified. You can hear Elvis playing piano very, very faintly, chording in the background. Whether that would have stayed in the final version or not, I don't know. There is no rhythm guitar on this.
Well, Peter Guralnick, it's great to talk with you again. And Peter Guralnick has written a new biography of Sam Phillips, which is called Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. And there's also a companion double CD that has the same title. And this is the final track on that compilation. Thank you again, Peter.
Well, thanks, Terry. I've really enjoyed it.
I've been traveling over miles, even through the valleys too.
I've been traveling night and day. I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Ever since I read your letter, where you said you loved me true, I've been traveling night and day. I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. I kept traveling night and day. I kept running all the way, baby, trying to get to you.
Sam Phillips, the man who invented rock and roll, is the title of Peter Guralnick's new book, as well as a companion CD set. You can hear a longer version of Terry's conversation with Guralnick, with more music, on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair.
Well, if I had to do it over, that's exactly what I'd do. I would travel night and day, and I'd still run all the way, baby, trying to get to you.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.